all across Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Breitlove.
And welcome back to the second hour of Up North News Radio for this Wednesday, July 26th. Oh yeah, that's right. It's George Clinton's birthday too. No, not that George Clinton. Aaron, come on, man. George Clinton, the fourth vice president of the United States. We talked about this in the last segment. How could you confuse the two?
Well, like you said, there's so many Clintons.
So, yeah, I mentioned George Clinton. I'm going off on this whole thing about, you know, one of our early, you know, political leaders. And, yeah, up comes some great music from a different George Clinton. This Wednesday, July 26th, is also National Aunt and Uncle's Day. And coming up this hour, we're going to talk about the day that Hubert flipped the script. It was 75 years ago last Friday that a young Minneapolis mayor named Hubert Humphrey helped his party escape a slide toward irrelevance and find the courage to throw off the dead weight that came from decades of racism or coddling racism. And so Samuel Friedman has a new book called Into the Bright Sunshine, Young Hubert Humphrey and the Fight for Civil Rights, to describe how the future vice president went from naive dreamer to modern leader. And we'll talk to him as well about how Wisconsin leaders at the time handled the long march toward embracing civil rights. So that's coming up at 7:30 this morning. If you missed our last hour, you can catch all of our shows anytime by going to civicmedia.us, where you can find every show, every hour of every show. Listen back there. Or subscribe to it as a podcast on Spotify and Apple and all those places. We'd love to have you along doing things that way. Or if you want to follow just what Up North News does, because Up North News is a separate entity from Civic Media, our website is upnorthnewswi.com. We put together a newsletter every morning that we feature, put in your mailbox around 5 a.m., help you follow some uniquely and unabashedly Wisconsin stories and headlines. So just go to the website and sign up for the newsletter there, or find everything that we're doing in terms of Up North News on social media. Just look up Up North News WI. Don't forget the WI on a lot of those social media channels. We'd love to have you along. Aaron, I ran out of time to ask Melissa Kay about this in our last segment, but there is a really nice article in the Journal Sentinel. Jordan Nenning is the author, with the headline, "What is Sheep's Head? And why is it so popular in Wisconsin?" And honestly, if I hadn't married into a family that plays Sheep's Head endlessly, I don't even know if I would have understood the headline. But as I say, I did marry into a dairy farm family from Manitowoc County, where they'll play Sheep's Head for 6-8 hours or longer on some Sundays when they get together, and they're not alone. There's a lot of that going on out there. Now, you're from the Manitowoc area. Where are you on Sheep's Head?
See, that's me and my family with cribbage.
That's me and my wife. We play cribbage almost every evening, even though she grew up in a Sheep's Head family. So I totally hear you there.
Yeah, I haven't played Sheep's Head, which is surprising how into card and board games I am. I'd like to. It just hasn't happened yet.
And so we asked Melissa, and again, we didn't get time to talk about it on air, if she was a Sheep's Head player. And what did she mention? She mentioned euchre.
Yes.
And which one of you brought up pinochle?
She did. She said that she also plays pinochle.
I did. Honestly, I didn't know anybody still played pinochle. I've heard of euchre a lot. I've never played euchre, but pinochle is one I haven't heard the word in forever, but clearly it's still out there in some circles.
Yeah. I also said over the break that some people in college learned how to play beer pong or boom cup or whatever else these other drinking games are that I've never played. I learned how to play pinochle.
See, and there was, you know, that long phase where everything was about poker. Everybody was learning poker. Poker was new on TV and everything. And, you know, of course, it's still out there. But for some families, and not just out, you know, in eastern Wisconsin, here in Chippewa County as well, there are Sheep's Head tournaments and things. And so this article that Jordan Nunnig did in the Journal Sentinel is a really good attempt to describe Sheep's Head. And I have to say attempt because, look, I've been exposed to this game for going on 40 years now. And only very recently do I feel like I can actually hold my own when you're sitting there with four other people who are far more experienced playing this card game. And as the article notes, I mean, in some circles, Sheep's Head is synonymous with cheese and beer when it comes to Wisconsin culture. And she explains that there are different ways to play Sheep's Head, which, again, I wouldn't have necessarily known. All we play is five-handed pick Jack of Diamonds. But there's also a called Ace version, which is more popular in the Milwaukee area. There's an attempt to explain the history of Sheep's Head, but like so many things, there really wasn't a definitive history written in the early days. And so it's just a guess, if nothing else. And then it's all about, you know, what are the Trump suits? You know, what's high, what's low? How do you score the points? How do you play what on what? Which, again, you can do with Euchre, you can do with Pinochle, you can do with Bridge and all kinds of things. And I do wonder amongst our own listeners, if there is either a favorite or a story about trying to learn a card game and, you know, it worked or it didn't work. And you can call us at 844-967-2789. I actually took several years off of Sheep's Head once when my two nieces, who were like 8 and 10 at the time, rolled their eyes at me at the way that I played a hand. And I said, that's it. If these little girls are going to mock me, I'm clearly not ready for this. And I eventually came back to it. Love to know what you think of that as well. Much more headlines and author Sam Friedman still to come here up north.
Day after day, I'm more confused. Yet I look for the light through the pouring rain.
Toby Gray, born this day in 1940, 83 years ago. That, of course, is his big hit here. We've got an update from Weatherology coming up in just a second, right after I tell you that here in Chippewa Falls, we just had some thunder roll through, a little bit of some thunderstorm action. I thought I might have seen a watch box here or there as some of the noise went past. A little bit of rain, nothing terrible in our neck of the woods, but let's see how it's looking for the rest of what continues to be a very warm midweek with Jennifer Wojcicki here from Weatherology to give us all the details. Jennifer, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, and it does look like still a few scattered showers and thunderstorms for most across the listening area, primarily in the morning hours today, then drying out for most by the afternoon, but lingering storm chances in the afternoon hours around Waukesha and Milwaukee. A marginal risk for severe weather today from Milwaukee over to Madison, drying out earlier today around Amory and Baldwin, then becoming mostly sunny there. A hot day for all, but there will be a heat advisory that will go into effect at 10 a.m. Today for just Baldwin, mid to upper 80s for most, around 90s for Madison over to Richland Center, and for the southwestern parts of the state today. Thursday, sunny and dry for the southern half of the state during the daytime hours, and a chance for showers and storms by night. Looks like a chance for storms during the day from Wausau over to west central Wisconsin tomorrow, and it does look like a marginal risk for severe weather tomorrow across most of the state as well. A little bit warmer as we'll see highs mostly in the 90s tomorrow, a few lingering in the 80s closer to Lake Michigan. Friday, a chance for showers and storms across the board, mid to upper 80s for most in the 90s for southwest Wisconsin. And then for the weekend, it actually looks like a dry forecast and a cooler one at that as well, as a cold front pushes through. Sunny skies both Saturday and Sunday, mid 70s actually to right around about 80 degrees on Saturday, mainly around the low 80s for Sunday.
Best thing to have would be some sunscreen. Otherwise, sunscreen and some pontoon keys would be even better. Jennifer, thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too.
There's Jennifer Wojcicki from Weatherology. Currently 70 degrees up here on Lake Wasota, 70 in La Crosse, 71 in Hayward, 74 degrees right now in Madison. Coming up in just a few minutes here, Samuel Friedman, author of Into the Bright Sunshine, Young Hubert Humphrey, and The Fight for Civil Rights, all about what happened at the Democratic National Convention 75 years ago in getting the party to turn the page on its ways of either being all-out segregationist or simply tolerating the segregationists in the party. So look for that coming up in just a few minutes. The Milwaukee Brewers still lead the National League Central Division, but only by a half game after losing to the Cincinnati Reds last night. The Brewers had trailed 4-0 heading into the ninth inning, almost came all the way back, Christian Yelich had a 3-run homer with 2 outs in the bottom of the ninth, but eventually the Reds were able to get the final out and get that 4-3 victory. They'll play again this afternoon. It will be their 13th and final matchup of the regular season. They really crammed a lot of their division games into the middle part of the season, where the Reds have only won 3 of the 12 games so far against the Brewers. The same Reds team has gone 32-9 against all the other teams since May 25th. And again, you can catch today's game with Freddie Peralta on the mound at WRCE News from the Center and Richland Center, or Oshkosh Air Support, 98.3 FM. The Brewers are off tomorrow. Then they travel to Atlanta and then to Washington, D.C. to play the Nationals. They'll be back home next Thursday for a division series against the Pirates. I hear grandchildren waking up in the distance in case you hear any protests about, you know, whether they can have cake for breakfast or grandma's cookies that she made yesterday. I have to tell you about an article I just saw, an opinion piece. I saw it in the Journal Sentinel, but it's actually from Amelia Robinson, who is an editor, an opinion and community engagement editor with the Columbus Dispatch. And it's about not just about the Barbie movie and about Barbies, but the predictable, if not somewhat upsetting, backlash to all of it. And the headline on it being, "Failed Barbie Backlash is Part of the War on Magic, Creativity, Joy, and Human Potential." And while I would understand if people said you're being hyperbolic, when you see and hear some of the backlash to the Barbie movie, you understand that it's not, that there's just a troubling segment of the population that is very much in line with something we talked about in the last hour. And that, again, is views on masculinity and how many people, including a majority of Republican voters in a public opinion poll, who said the best way to raise children is to have, you know, two parents at home, a man who's the breadwinner, and a woman who stays home and raises the children. You know, the Leave It to Beaver scenario that happened far less often than people think. Again, this whole notion that there was some kind of a fairy tale in America's past, and if only we could get back to that. And that was never the case. And so looking at this opinion piece by Amelia Robinson, she talked about the way that, you know, what happened with the Barbie movie has triggered anti-magic, creativity, joy, and human potential crusaders. And even though Barbie did well with a $155 million box office opening weekend, you know, there's still plenty of people who look at Barbie and dismiss it for all the wrong reasons. For example, thinking of Barbie as some kind of a one-dimensional bimbo, when whatever Barbie may have been decades before, Barbie is now a rock star, a school teacher, a doctor, a ballerina, a mother, a fast driver, an Olympic swimmer, a model, a journalist. Barbie still has an itty bitty waist that does not sit well with some people, nor the hot pink Porsche. But Barbie also is no longer just blonde haired and blue eyed. You know, the dolls are black. They are brown. They're Kens. You know, they were at times married to Spider-Man and G.I. Joe. And, you know, they had all kinds of different lives. And yet there is this backlash, the word I keep using here, from people like, you know, one well-known conservative commentator. I'm not even going to mention his name, but he writes, "All you need to know about Barbie is that it unironically uses the word patriarchy more than 10 times. And, you know, talked about dressing up like Ken and setting some Barbie dolls on fire as part of this whole anti-woke rant." And that's really what this comes into, is this pushback against, you know, creativity and joy and human potential, as she writes. There's, you know, legislation pending that talks about wokeness as some kind of a gateway drug. And what she writes here, and this is the quote that really stuck out at me, In other words, it makes some people very, very uncomfortable to see women out of the kitchen, black people out of the field, and gay people out of the closet. And it's why there is this campaign to cast certain books and lesson plans as evil indoctrinating villains, whether they be historical, cultural, or fictional. It's why artists, not just drag queens, but going back to Michelangelo, have been demonized as vulgar. And she writes, it's why large American cities have been painted as wicked and dangerous places. Those who seek to smother out magic, creativity, joy, and human potential have a reason to fear. Because she writes, as the famous saying goes, if you can imagine it, you can achieve it. If you can dream it, you can become it. If you can imagine a just world where people live freely, you might just do the things it takes to make this world the world of your dreams. You might be the one, Amelia Robinson concludes. With the Barbie dream house, with dolls in a variety of skin colors, sizes, ethnicities, sexual orientations, and gender. And I think what she and I and others are trying to say is, what the hell is wrong with that? Mike from Oklahoma joins us to talk a bit about the subject. Mike, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. I have this word kiwiness is a newly added word to the Oxford Dictionary in 2023. Kiwiness, like a kiwi fruit.
Okay.
You type that into Rumble. It's a monetized dictionary word.
Okay.
Changes the game a little bit if there's only one video there, right? For a dictionary word.
Mm-hmm.
So if I said, how come people don't know how to monetize words yet, but we all know what pictures on the blockchain are? Because I think I just made a fortune off your audience. They add a hashtag, it goes to a second level. And Jennifer Sulzberger has a patent on that. And all the elected officials who don't use signs outside with a vocabulary word on it to generate views are missing out on encouraging literacy at...
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate that, Mike, but we'll try to keep things to the Barbie movie and, you know, not do our own little pitches for blockchains or what have you here. So again, if you have some input on actually seeing the movie, and by the way, I was hoping that today was going to be the day I was going to tell you about seeing it. That was the original plan, again, with the daughters and the grandkids here in town, that we were going to go see the Barbie movie. It's still sold out up here in Chippewa Falls. So we will get to it maybe as early as today if we get tickets early enough. And I still plan to see Oppenheimer as well. So we definitely will have some movie magic to chatter about. Right now, though, I'm relying on people like Amelia Robinson's critique to tell us more about the Barbie movie. And I also figured out, Aaron, why I have been saying the other movie's name wrong occasionally, instead of saying Oppenheimer the way that I should. And I'm like, where's this coming from? I realized I'm from the Midwest. We say Ope all the time.
Yep. That's
so why wouldn't Oppenheimer fall out of your mouth?
I figured that's what it was.
Just, so look, that one needs to be there as well. And we'll look at that and see what people think. I don't know. Mark from Prairie to Sac calls in frequently and is calling in here. So I don't know, Mark, if you've seen one movie or the other, or want to comment on Amelia Robinson's critique about, you know, the toxic masculinity pushback to it. How are you this morning?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good, and I won't be able to see a movie now for probably a few weeks. I've still got a chest tube in me with a kind of uncomfortable collection box alongside me. But I'm looking forward to seeing the Barbie movie. I like this, you know, kind of out there little thing that, and actually, you know, it's amazing to me that it sounds like a movie that can make people think. And the reaction that I'm getting from the reaction the right wing is having is making me more interested in seeing the movie, you know, in the first place. I mean, these people are having a meltdown over a movie, over a fun, what sounds like a really fun movie, and poking a little fun at the patriarchy and trying to make a point that, you know, that we should have made a lot more progress than we haven't had, and that people are still trying to drag us back to some fictionalized version of the 50s where father knows best and leave it to Beaver, and that world just never really existed.
No, it never did. Mark, Mark, you are sounding so much better. Thank you. I hope the recovery continues going well. And we'll both compare notes on the movie real soon, okay? Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. You know, and that's the other thing. I mean, look, I'll be the first to admit, the first time I saw the Barbie movie trailer, I rolled my eyes. And then as I learned more about, you know, that it was Greta Gerwig who was directing it, you knew it was going to be something smart. And I'm looking forward to seeing it. Author Sam Friedman is coming up next, and we're talking about a major turning point for the Democratic Party 75 years ago. Next, you're up north.
To those who say, my friends, to those who say that we are rushing this issue of civil rights, I say to them, we are 172 years late. To those who say that this civil rights program is an infringement on states' rights, I say this, the time has arrived in America for the Democratic Party to get out of the shadows of states' rights and to walk forthrightly into the bright sunshine of human rights.
That is a young Hubert Humphrey at the 1948 Democratic National Convention, before he became a long-serving U.S. Senator from Minnesota and Vice President of the United States. Back then, he was the mayor of Minneapolis, but his remarks that day in Philadelphia, 75 years ago last week, helped drag the Democratic Party, some of them kicking and screaming, away from the shame of segregation or the equally shameful trait of timidity and kowtowing to the racists. Humphrey spoke for those who knew Democrats had become a permanent minority or even a non-entity in places like Wisconsin, and that it was past time to fight for a platform language that supported civil rights for Black Americans. Author Samuel Friedman has written a new book, Into the Bright Sunshine, Young Hubert Humphrey and the Fight for Civil Rights, and he joins us this morning here on Up North News Radio. Sam Friedman, good morning.
It's great to be with you, Pat. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, thank you again for being part of this. Now, I will confess to the listeners, as I did to you, my interest here is beyond the norm, having been raised both in the Twin Cities as well as in Eau Claire, mm-hmm. and that Senator Humphrey was a larger-than-life elder statesman in my younger years until his passing in 1978. And it surprised me later in life, and kind of does to this day, that history has not given Humphrey his due, and understandably the Vietnam War and the 1968 presidential campaign, you know, were central to that. But now with the passage of time, it's easier to kind of separate the layers. And so if we can set aside the layers of the 1960s and examine the period of the late 40s and 50s, where did Hubert Humphrey leave his mark on history?
Well, Hubert Humphrey was one of the most important civil rights leaders in this country for a long period of time, especially during the 1940s, which is kind of this overlooked but really essential period of civil rights activity. Humphrey was right there alongside people like A. Philip Randolph, the great Black labor and civil rights leaders, and Walter White, the NAACP, in pushing forward on civil rights in a decade when fighting the war against global fascism had inevitably raised the question of what America was going to do about the forms of intolerance and racial supremacy and religious bigotry here in the homeland. And he was one of the most important voices on that issue. And starting out as mayor in Minneapolis, just a few miles up 94 from where you are in Chippewa Falls, he made Minneapolis a national model of progress on civil rights, coming out of a period when Minneapolis had been deservedly reviled as one of the most discriminatory cities in the whole country against Blacks and also against Jews.
As well as it was, it and St. Paul were just these huge centers of gangland activity as well. And so you mm-hmm. had crusaders like Humphrey that, you know, perhaps some other Midwestern cities didn't have and would have been wise to have. But I will ask it this way. Why was it him in 1948? Was it a case of, you know, let this young upstart mayor, let him go out there and commit political suicide? Or was he indeed a, you know, a motivator and a leader, you know, who, you know, matched the expectations others put in him?
The answer, Pat, is both. He was on a mission. And I've often said that the question was whether it was a political suicide mission, but he firmly believed in it. And just to sort of contextualize for, you know, for your listeners and your online viewers, as great a president as Franklin Roosevelt was, he'd never been willing to confront the Southern segregationist wing of the party on the Jim Crow system, not in his platform, not in the way New Deal programs were written, not in the way they were administered locally. And Harry Truman was of two minds heading into the 48 election. Partly he was advancing on civil rights, and then the closer he got to the election, the more he wanted to back away and just kick that can down the road the way FDR had. And you also had Southern segregationists saying, we're going to bolt from the party if you do anything on civil rights. And then finally, you had A. Philip Randolph, who I mentioned before, leading a mass movement to have Black young men not register for the draft or not serve unless Harry Truman desegregated the military. And so into this turmoil, here's Humphrey as part of an insurgency within the Democratic Party pushing a real civil rights plank, something that explicitly says we're going to integrate the military, we're going to have fair employment practices, we're going to put an end to lynching, and so forth. And partly because of his emerging national reputation, and partly because of his great oratorical skills, he's given the task of selling this platform plank to the whole convention. That happens July 14th, 1948. And it's not just that he's talking to 1,500 delegates and alternates, and it's not just that he's talking to 15,000 people in the convention hall. Believe it or not, there are 70 million people watching on TV or listening on radio to that speech in real time. It's like the Super Bowl in terms of audience.
That's a great point as well, because again, political conventions were, well, they weren't the produced stage shows that they are today. Actual business happened there. And in that age of radio and early TV, I mean, people really hung on what was in a party platform. It told you quite literally what it stood for compared to, say, the 2020 Republican Party, which said, we're not going to have a platform. It's whatever Donald Trump wants, which just tells you how far we've come. Let's get to the Wisconsin tie for a moment here and start in Wisconsin. Now, we know one of Wisconsin's U.S. senators back then was Joseph McCarthy, and history has given him all the scorn he deserves, and we can get to him. But I also want to make note that Wisconsin's other senator at the time, Alexander Wiley, was from right here in Chippewa Falls. And so I wanted to know, between Wiley, McCarthy, other Wisconsin figures, you know, to what degree did they figure either into Humphrey's moves or other either support or opposition to embracing civil rights?
Well, there's a great Wisconsin angle here that I'm very happy to share. You know, Humphrey couldn't just stand up and give the speech because he wanted to give the speech. There's a whole complicated process of how you put a platform plank up to all the delegates. And it wasn't easy to do, especially when the incumbent president wanted to have this quashed in committee. And one of Humphrey's most important allies was a labor leader and former member of Congress from Milwaukee, and former member before that of state legislature, named Andrew B. Miller, who everyone called Andy. And Andy B. Miller was an expert in parliamentary procedure. And not only was he allied with Humphrey on civil rights, but he understood all these abstruse and intricate rules on how, even if you had lost on your platform plank in the platform committee, which Humphrey had, you could get a second chance speaking to the whole convention. And it actually shocked Truman's people who were running the convention that Andy B. Miller knew how to maneuver it so that Humphrey could get to give the speech. And he and Humphrey had been planning this out for weeks ahead. Heading into the convention, Humphrey goes down to the Milwaukee area where Andy B. Miller has a house a little bit outside Milwaukee, sort of in the Pewaukee area, if not in Pewaukee itself. And they map out, here's how we're going to make sure that we are able to give the speech, even if we lose at an earlier stage. So B. Miller is one of the unsung heroes of this. And of course, the Wisconsin delegation at the convention votes in favor of this plank. As you said, this was a really key issue in many parts of the country, not just states that had a large number of Black voters, where you had a lot of big city political bosses saying, we've got to endorse civil rights because we've got to improve turnout, or not only are we going to lose the presidency, but we're going to lose all the down ballot races. But you had states like Wisconsin with this, you know, progressive and liberal tradition, also, unfortunately, that counter tradition of people like Joe McCarthy, but at least in the Democratic Party, a tradition that wanted to keep moving forward with a liberal agenda. And civil rights in 48 was the key part of that agenda.
And it was because, again, for folks who might be too, you know, too young to really appreciate this, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 didn't happen in a vacuum. This was decades in the making of filibuster after filibuster after filibuster, primarily from, you know, Democrats and Southern Democrats at the time. And it took people like Hubert Humphrey and others to flip the script. And so you hear people today saying, well, you know, our party, the Republican Party, our party is the party of Lincoln, and your party is the one of segregation. Well, yeah, once upon a time, but you're kind of ignoring history, especially 1948, if you're still sticking to that trope.
Exactly. What happens in 1948 is when the civil rights plank wins and Harry Truman ends up needing to run as a civil rights candidate. And 2 weeks after the convention, he issues executive orders desegregating the military and desegregating the federal workforce. That's the realignment we're living with now. That moment sets Democrats enduringly on the path to being a multiracial interfaith party of inclusive democracy. When the Dixiecrats, Southern Democrats, leave, that's the beginning of the process that will lead them to become Republicans, starting with Barry Goldwater in 64, Nixon in 68, Reagan in 80, and now Donald Trump, you know, in 16 and 20 and probably 24 as well. So it is when the script gets flipped, and it's so intellectually dishonest to say that the Democrats still are the party of segregation. When they ousted their extremists in 1948, they did what the Republicans have been totally unwilling to do with Trump and with the Trump movement, which is kick out the crazies, kick out the bigots.
Right. And it's not a given that the GOP would simply accept having the script flipped and allow itself to become the modern day bastion of opposition to civil rights, voting rights, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and even an honest teaching of American history. So what led the party of Lincoln to become the party of Lee Atwater and Karl Rove and now Donald Trump?
Well, the first thing that happens is you have the Goldwater insurgency in 64. That's the kind of the beginning of the rise of the new right, even though by today's standards, Goldwater would probably be in the Lincoln Project. But Goldwater comes out against civil rights laws. He doesn't seem to be personally bigoted, but he makes this argument of quote unquote states' rights. And that's a dog whistle to Southern segregationists to vote for him, especially when he's running against LBJ in 64, who's already pushed through with Hubert Humphrey's help, the Civil Rights Act of 64. Although Goldwater loses massively, it's a sign that Republicans can get votes from the segregationists of the South. And Richard Nixon then in 68, who'd previously been pretty progressive on civil rights. In fact, Martin Luther King almost endorsed Nixon for president in 1960. Richard Nixon runs on the so-called Southern strategy, which means, again, to appeal to this opposition to civil rights in the South and moves forward on that progress. Ronald Reagan, again, someone who I don't think at a personal level was a bigot, but is willing to play that card, starts the 1980 campaign with rally in Philadelphia, Mississippi, near the place where the three civil rights martyrs, Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman, were murdered by white vigilantes. So this is all a process that moves along. And even though there are some Republican candidates who push against it and try to bring it back towards the party of Lincoln, like John McCain, and with all of his other flaws, George W. Bush, I think, was the best Republican president on race since Lincoln, but they lose control of the party, and now we are where we are. And that's a point where you can't even teach honestly about slavery anymore.
Isn't that something? So my last question, I've got a minute for this, is what are the chances this can flip again? Say 75 years from now, can we say that some young Republican halted their party's march toward extremism and irrelevance the way the Democrats faced it back then? Or is the money too much? Is the media infrastructure too rigid for the Republican Party to change its ways?
I think they have to lose a lot more elections and lose them badly, and then hopefully someone will emerge. Either that or the party will formally crack into two things, and one part of it will take up the voice of what the Republican Party used to be on issues of racial equality.
Samuel Friedman is an award-winning professor, columnist, author of 9 acclaimed books, a staff reporter from the New York Times from 81 to 87, and so much more. And the book, again, is called Into the Bright Sunshine, Young Hubert Humphrey and the Fight for Civil Rights. Sam, thank you so much. It was great to be able to talk to you, and let's do it again a little later as you're making this book tour.
I totally enjoyed it, Pat. I'll be very glad to be back. Thanks so much.
Thank you. All right, back with Todd Alba after this. You're up north.
And equality wisely well. My good friends, I ask my party, I ask the Democratic Party, to march down the high road of progressive democracy. I ask this convention to say in unmistakable terms that we proudly hail and we courageously support our president and leader, Harry Truman, in his great fight for civil rights in America.
Okay, here's something about the different approaches that we have here is that for Todd Alba, who likes to think of himself as somewhat of a moderate these days, he's got Steeler's wheel stuck in the middle with you. I kick off my show every day with Stevie Ray Vaughan talking about being caught in the crossfire. We're just a couple of average American boys who want us all to get along a little bit better. And I'm glad that we had that author, Sam Friedman, on just now to talk about how Hubert Humphrey tried to play a role in that. Todd Alba, if we don't have any tech glitches and you can hear me, how are you?
I'm okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah, hear you just great.
All right, fantastic. It all works. So yeah, he was fantastic. I was listening a little bit before I came on, and always good to go back and remember history to try not to repeat it, right?
Yeah. Well, it was encouraging to be reminded of how Hubert Humphrey came to become, a political hero for a time. Obviously, it was tainted a bit by losing to Richard Nixon in 1968. But I have to say, it was also rather maddening, and you would appreciate this more than me, I think, having worked in the Republican Party. Mm. But for me to be reminded that this isn't before it was Donald Trump's party, it was Karl Rove. And before Karl Rove, it was Lee Atwater. And I do not say this lightly. There are very few people that I would reserve a special place in hell for. And for me, what Lee Atwater did to the Republican Party, embracing as much of the racist tropes as he did to help out for the greater good, Karl Rove was just the latest in that line. And it genuinely makes me angry to think about the people that would basically, they may not, it's not that they started out as racist, but they see racism as a political strategy to victory. And that enrages me.
Stuart Stevens, who is part of the Lincoln Project, who's been our show once and hopefully get it back again. He wrote a great book, which I'm in the middle of rereading again, which is called It Was All a Lie: How the Republican Party Became Donald Trump. And for me, who spent 30 years as a Republican and left in 2011, it's both cathartic and maddening. And there's even some humor thrown in there as well. I think your point is a great one, Pat. And that is, and I really appreciated your guest saying, you know, George W. Bush was probably the most progressive on civil rights since Richard Nixon in terms of Republican presidents and administrations. And even he, of course, was influenced and got into office with the help of Karl Rove. So I think a lot of times there's these kind of figure people in the party who are not necessarily racist or bad people themselves. I don't believe that George Bush is, but it's these people that are the mechanics, the people running the machine on the inside that get into these parties that quite frankly don't have the courage or the ability to run for office themselves, and so create chaos. You might be able to remember the name. I can't remember it. And as a gay person myself, it infuriates me. But there was a Republican operative for years, the Republican Party, who himself was closeted gay and ran some of the most atrocious, terrible anti-gay ads for Republicans across the country. And that's the kind of party that it has been in all. Now, again, I don't want to paint all Republicans that way. My former boss, Dale Schultz and Scott Klug, certainly not in that camp. There are others. But I think we're looking at the mechanics of the party at the top tiers nationally, and now even little by little at the state level. It's extraordinarily disturbing, particularly for someone who spent so many years in that party.
You remind me that both George W. Bush and George H.W. Bush, and frankly, Richard Nixon, who looks like, you know, a lefty loon, you know, through the prism of history for embracing the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and things like that, that there's a difference between how you govern versus how you win an election. And I am completely guilty here of painting with an overly broad brush. But Democrats fall short far too often saying, I'm going to campaign on ideas and policy, and when I win, I will put those in effect. And Republicans, and again, I am being overly cynical, but not unwarranted, that we'll do whatever we got to win. If we got to use, you know, various tactics of fear and whatnot, we may actually be quite moderate, but we got to win this election. So we're going to do what we got to do.
Yeah, I think that's very true. Again, painting with very broad brushes. I brought this movie up before, and, you know, Primary Colors from there was a novel, first of all, and then a movie. Yes. And I watch it usually a couple times a year just because it makes me laugh. Partly, I love Billy Bob Thornton in the yes. movie. But it kind of drives home this point, right? That in the movie, which is based supposedly on the primary of Bill Clinton in 92. That he was a very flawed individual and was surrounded by people that would do anything to get him there. But he himself was in it for the right reasons. And basically the movie makes you think, does the ends justify the means? And that's what so much of politics is about.
Well, and I think if we're going to actually flip this around and talk about Democrats, I think one of the things that's especially maddening to voters, especially the further left they are, is that you have Democratic candidates who run embracing a lot of left-leaning provisions, but then they're perceived as far too moderate or cautious or timid when they get into office. Now, maybe some of that is the realities of trying to get something passed through Congress, but I would argue as well, you know, especially somebody like a Joe Biden. Joe Biden talks a good game, but he was never a flaming liberal when it comes to the policies, even though he's also the guy who, like Humphrey, you know, was reading the temperature in the room and saying, hey, guys, we got to embrace, you know, same-sex marriage. He got ahead of his boss, President Obama, at that point. But by and large, he doesn't have that reputation.
Yeah, I you're right. It happens on both sides of the party. I was never obviously in your caucuses on the Democratic side, but on the Republican side, you know, my boss is one of them. There were others where when you first get to Madison or to Washington and you have kind of these pure high ideals that you run on and you actually believe them. But part of the problem is, Pat, agree or disagree, you get in those caucuses and you're surrounded by, even 10, 20 years ago, loons or far right or far left people that muck up the inner workings of the caucus. It has to be even 10 times worse today. So even a person that goes in for the right reason with the right intent, once you get there to achieve what you ran on, is sometimes virtually impossible because you can't get the caucus to give you the votes.
I'll never forget the 2010 running for re-election to the legislature and obviously lost later that year. It was the Tea Party year and people were seeing the writing on the walls. And I remember a couple of supporters, you know, confronting me and saying, you know, we're not going to donate to you anymore or support you until you get in front of a TV camera and promise to raise taxes for education. And I remember looking at them saying something along the lines of, I'm sorry, and I will miss your $50.
You know, yes, right.
Because, you know, you're actually looking to win so you can support education. Todd Alba, you find him weekdays 1 to 3 across Civic Media's radio network. Thank you, sir. Have a great day.
Thank you, Pat.
All right. And thank you, everybody, for being here as well. You can follow me on the face page over there. Just go to Pat Kreitlow Up North or Pat Kreitlow on Twitter. I'm on the new Threads as well. And you can sign up for our daily newsletter at upnorthnewswi.com. Have a great Wednesday. See you tomorrow.